at this chapter, and some of you right away got lost to the very beginning. Why? There are lots of names. Okay, it seemed also to be completely meaningless, to an extent, boring, okay, even, let's say, it certainly doesn't have the pizzazz of some of the other chapters in Lech Lecha. You will also notice that God's name does not appear in the chapter till way at the other end. It also is basically seems to be a story that tells us about a political, historical event. And as my father, Zichrono Livracha, would always say, he would say, well, what is it? Is it good for the Jews? Or, right? You all know that attitude. And that becomes the attitude. What does the War of the Four Kings and the Five Kings, as it's known, come to do with us? Now, as I said, what's nice about this chapter, let me just show you from a literal standpoint, is that we can actually cut this chapter into half, with 12 verses in each section. Okay? So section 1 would be verses 1 to 4, which we would call the setting the scene. We would call it
the original confederation
or the axis, right? Whatever term you have for a group who comes together. We call it, you know, the king's brief. Okay, let's just call it that, those confederation. Then we have 5 to 10, which talks about the actual war. And then we have 11 and 12, which would be the...
To the victor goes the spoils.
To the victor goes the spoils, that's right.
Very, very nice, to the victor goes the spoils.
That would be the first half. If we move to the second half, then we have verse 13. What does verse 13 talk about? Abraham's brief. Again, we have a brief here. This is the brief of Abraham with...
Well, he's still Abraham here.
Right, with Aner, Eshkol, and Mamre. Sue has more sheets, so please indicate to her if you need one. Then we have verse 14 and 15. What does 14 and 15 talk about? 14 and 15 is, again, this is the war where Abraham goes out to fight. And finally, we have 16 to 24, which again talks about spoils. Again, talks about spoils and who they belong to. So you see, from a literary standpoint, the chapter is completely parallel. The first 12 verses parallel the second 12, right? We have a brit and a brit. We have a war and a war. We have spoils and spoils. So that is a very nice approach to just to be able to map out the chapter. Now, when we continue, let's continue on to the who is fighting and what are they fighting about? Who is fighting and what are they fighting about? Is there an extra source sheet somewhere? Okay.
We've got what we call the four kings, thank you, and the five kings. Okay, let's start from the beginning. Okay, v'hi bimrei Amraphel melech Shinar, v'Eryoch melech Elsar, v'Kedala Omer melech Elim, v'Tidael melech Goyim. Those are the four kings. Now, those four kings, by the way, are what we would call the imperial forces. They are the strong forces. They are a huge army. And who are they going to war against? They're going against war to five, and we're calling them kings, but they're not even really kings. They're more what we would call perhaps sheikhs or mayors. They're heads of little towns around the Yam HaMelech area. And why are they coming to war? Why are the four kings coming against the five kings?
Is it territorial? Let's. There's some sort of confederation going on. For 12 years, the five kings have been paying taxes to the four kings. And now, at this point, the five kings have rebelled. Now, in what way does the rebellion probably manifest itself? Probably they stop paying the tribute that they're supposed to be paying. So then for 12 years they pay, then they stop paying, and so in the 13th year, this imperial army comes and says, well, that is just not acceptable behavior. Now, it could be that they killed the tax collectors. You know, you know enough about history that you can sort of, it's not just that they haven't paid, there's probably a lot more that goes with it. And in the 14th year, they come to fight. So 12 years they pay, 13th year they don't pay, 14th year they come to fight. Now, Abarbanel actually, there's actually an alternative opinion that they actually paid for 12 years. For 13 years, there was the rebellion. Right, because if you read the verses clearly, it's not, you can accept it either way. And then, so we're talking about a 25-year, as opposed to a 13-year story. Anyway, I think that's neither here nor there. But what happens in verse 5 and verse 6? It describes the movement of the four kings. Now, I put for you a map on the last page. Turn to the last page, and I apologize that's in Hebrew. I wasn't able to find an English one. Now, I also want to make you familiar with, at this point in time, a book called Atlas of Tekufat HaMikra. Okay? It is an atlas that goes through the different stories in Torah, and it gives you a map so that you can understand what's going on. The only problem with this is when you buy it, every couple of years you have to buy a new one because they keep finding more and it becomes outdated. I mean, I have this copy in my house. My daughter's an archaeologist and she's like, that has no value to it. Anyway, so
better than Dot Mikra.
So this, the map that you have is from Dot Mikra. Okay? It's again, you know, they're both the same idea. If you can see the four kings come from what says here, Shushan, it says Elim. They come from all the way down from Mesopotamia. They come around and they start here at the bottom by Shinar. Shinar is Babylonia. Then they come up and they pick up all these other nations on the way. And if you look at the little box, it's clearer. They fight with the Rephaim and the Zuzim and the Amim and the, right, you see it? These nations on the side, they come all the way down and then they come back up to the Yam HaMelech. Okay, which is what the Abarbanel suggests, that they really weren't interested in fighting with the five minor kings. They were really interested in fighting with these nations. Now, can anybody tell what that is, by the way? The Rephaim and the Zuzim. What is that today? Right. That's the Jordan, what we call Transjordan. They're coming down that path. Now, if you know history, that path that we call a Jordan is what connects Mesopotamia to Egypt. And it was a very important trade route. So we can imagine why that's important to the four kings, that route be open. So it seems to be that
essentially Highway
6. Yes, it is parallels, yes. Yes, except that it's on the other side of the Jordan, but it's that same parallels, that same road. And if you start thinking about it, you understand the significance of that route. And according to the Abarbanel, he says that actually the four kings came out to secure that trade route, and once they were out already, then they might as well, you know, clear up the whole area as well. So when we look at the first couple of verses here, it seems to be to us that this is a war based on economy, politics, power. It seems to be that kind of war. We have no mention of Avraham at all in the first half of the chapter, meaning that what was Avraham doing while this war was going on? Right, doing his own thing, minding his own business, staying out. And what ends up really happening is, if you look at this, and it's the four kings or this imperial power, I think what we're probably talking about is the significance of a almost world war. Right? That's what you're talking about at this time in history. You're talking about the major powers are going out on a military conquest. Now, if you talk about something like the Rephaim, who live there? Does anybody know? The guys who live in Rephaim are giants. The giants live there. Now, the fact of the matter is that these kings are able to beat the giants and beat all these other major powers along the way indicate that we're talking about a significant military force. We also have this idea, by the way, that the first time a word appears in Torah, that is where it sets the impression that it's going to have for the rest of the chapters. So what word do we have here for the first time? We have the word milchama. This is the first time the word milchama appears. And Rav Hirsch points out to us that this is a war that the kings are initiating, and it has very little positive effect on the local little guy. And he says, unfortunately, that's usually what happens at war. The little guy is the guy who loses out. Anyway, Asu milchama. Now let's take a look at the names of the five kings. The names of the five kings appears in Pasuk Bet. What is the name of the king of Melech Sedom?
His name is Bera.
What word do you see in that name?
You see the name Ra, very clearly.
Who's our next king?
His name is Hirsha.
What word do you see there?
You see Rasha, very clearly. Then we have Birsha Melech Amor. Then we have Shin'ah.
What name do you see there? Sin'ah, right? And we'll come back to what that is in a minute. And then we have Shem Aver, Melech Tzva'im.
I'm going to show you this inside in a minute. Shem Aver and Melech Bela Hitzos.
Now, if you take a look at source number one, I brought it for you once in the Medrash and once from Rashi, because Rashi bases on Medrash, and the Rashi I was able to find in English. So I brought you the Rashi in English, then the Medrash in Hebrew. The Medrash says like this, Bera. He's called Bera because he was evil to heaven and evil to people. In other words, we have a bad man. Birsha, he was elevated in his wickedness. Shin'av, shehu sonei sanua la'av shebashamayim. He hated his father in heaven. Shem Aver, you don't like this one. He made wings to fly and to spring and to rebel against the Holy One, blessed be he. So in other words, and Bela, by the way, is the name of the city, not the name of the king, but that's a side point. So in other words, what we're already establishing is that based on this Rashi, based on this Medrash, we would have to call the five kings, we would call them in today's language, the evil empire. Correct. That is what we would call them. These are the five kings.
Right.
Asu milchama and Bela Melech Sedom, Birsha Melech Amora, Shinav Melech Adma, Shem Eva Melech Tzavim, Umelech Bela Hitzoah. Those are the five kings. Okay. Shem Eva means that he built some sort of contraption in order to go fight against God. That's what the Medrash explains.
And Bela,
that the Medrash doesn't deal with. The fifth king is here. One, two, three, four, five.
Bela was the place.
Okay, we could accept that. I'm fine with that as well. Now, these five go to war with these four Mesopotamian kings. Now, one of these kings, some of these kings we actually happen to know. Who, the main king there of the four kings is a king named Amraphel. The main king of the four kings is Amraphel. And if you look in Source 1b, which begins at the bottom of page 2 and continues on to page 3, is the Gemara in Masechet Eruvin. The Gemara in Masechet Eruvin tells us, Vayhi bimei Amraphel, Rav Ushmuel, Chad Amar Nimrod. He says, this guy Amraphel is really somebody we know. And who is it? It's Nimrod. Now, who is Nimrod? Nimrod is famous because he's the one in last week's Parsha who threw Avraham into the furnace. Right? Remember that story that everybody grows up with because you learn it like in Gan, and then you become an adult and you see that it's not written anywhere in the Mikra? I'm going to come back to that point. At the end if we have time to, but for the most part it is, Rav says that it is this guy named Amraphel, and why is he came Amraphel? Shehipil, that he threw Avraham into the Kivshan Ha'esh. And somebody said, the other opinion says, no, his real name is Amraphel, but he's called Nimrod earlier because Nimrod has the root word of
Mered,
that he is somebody who rebelled. So either way, we have Amraphel, who is Nimrod. One is the first name, one is the second name. That's irrelevant. And it seems to be that he is the ruler, the head of the four kings. Now, once we know this, we're going to see that it's sort of going to change our whole perspective of the chapter. Because when we talk about Amraphel, we talk about Nimrod, we're talking about Avraham's arch enemy. And why does he throw Avraham into the furnace? It's not political, it's not economic, it's religious, it's ideological. Avraham is spreading the name of a single god, and Nimrod is saying that idea is unacceptable, and he tries to kill Avraham to get rid of Avraham's message. And it seems to be that if we look at source number 3, which appears at the bottom of page 4, we have a Zohar. And we have that I was also able to find in English. The Zohar there says, note that when all these kings joined together to make war on Avram, they designed to make away with him. But as soon as they got possession of Lot, his brother's son, they went off. I'll show you the pasuk in a minute. The reason being that Lot closely resembled Avraham, so that thinking that they had Avram, they went off. And the reason of their enmity to Avram was that Avram weaned men from idolatry and taught them to worship God. What is the Zohar saying? The Zohar is saying that you read about a world war. Your initial reaction is, what does this have to do with
Avraham?
And the Zohar is telling you that this war has everything to do with Avraham. That they were coming out specifically to pick up Avraham. Now, why are they, what is the, why are they taking this pasuk, or this approach? Because if you look at verse 12, go back to the chapter and look at verse 12. It says, Vayikhu et Lot ve'et ruchusho ben achi Avram. They take Lot and they take all of his possessions, the nephew of Avraham. We already know that Lot is Avram's nephew. Why would the pasuk need to repeat that point? Vayelchu. And after they take Lot, what do? They leave. In other words, it sounds from verse 12 that what was their goal? Their goal was to take Lot. Now, why do they take Lot if they're looking for Avram? So the Zohar suggested to us that Lot and Avram looked very much alike. And so they grabbed Lot. They thought it was Avraham. That's one possibility. A second possibility is that they know that once they take Lot, Avraham is going to come after him. So either of those suggestions are possible. So here, everything, and I think that this becomes sort of the idea of this chapter, is that everything in the world, even if it doesn't seem at first glance to somehow affect the Jewish people, somehow it always does. Now, if we take a look back here at, let me find the source for you. We also have this idea that at one point in time, Avram realizes that going out to fight against the kings, he's risking his life, but he's willing to risk his life because he says that this is an issue of defending God's name. And I'll find you the source in a second. No. All right, we'll find it as we go through it. I'll show it to you inside when we come. So anyway, how does Avraham find out that Lot has been captured?
Somebody
escaped from the war and comes to tell Avraham. Now, anybody who went to Gan knows who was the refugee. Og. See, thank you very much. Og, the giant, who becomes Melech HaBashan, is the refugee from the war. This is a very, very well-known Midrash. And let me show it to you inside so that you can see it inside. It comes from, Rashi brings it, the Midrash brings it, and you'll see it here. And I did bring it for you in English. We have it here in source number top of page 4. Actually, it starts at the bottom of page 3. It's 2b. 2b says, Vayavo hapalit. Reish lakish b'shem bar kafra omer. Hu og hu hapalit. He is og, he is the palit. And why is his name Og? Now this is interesting. Sheba umatsa et Avram yoshev v'osek b'mitzvot ugot. He comes to Avram, and Avram specifically making ugot. Now remember, when is Avram making ugot? When the angels come, he's making ugot. So we reference to that because it happens to be Pesach. We're going to come back to this as well. And you should just know that Og wasn't so righteous. He actually had some ulterior motives. Amar Ella Amar, he said to himself, Avram ze kunyan hu, achshav ani omer l'nishpa ben achicha v'yatei l'melchama. I already know that Avram is, you know, very close to his family, and when he hears that his nephew has been captured, he's going to right away got to learn what's going to happen to him. He's going to get killed. Va'anochi notel et Sarai ishto. And I am going to marry his wife. Now, Sarai, who is very beautiful. Now, when you learn this in Gan, you nod your head and you say, fantastic, right? But then, as an adult, you look back at this and you say, wait a minute. Let's say, hypothetically, that Avram gets killed at war. What? Why in the world would Sarah marry Og? Like, where does that piece fit in? Right, she's generations older than her, which is the other thing, by the way, another reason which Rashi brings us, that why is Og called Og? Why is he the Palit? Because he was actually the refugee from the Mabul. That he was saved from the Mabul. Many of you know this by hanging on to the Teva. And then, of course, Og comes back later on in Jewish history, but let me leave Og for a minute because I want to come back to this idea that this war is a war against Avraham. How else do I know that this is a war against Avraham? So we already saw the Zohar. We already say that this perhaps is the whole reason why the chapter is written, And if you look back at source 2, source 2 takes a verse from Tehillim. The verse reads, Cherev t'chu rishaim. The evil ones took out their swords, v'darko kashtam, and they bent their bows, lahapil ani ve'evyon, in order to capture a poor guy, litvoach yishrei dorach, in order to murder a righteous man. And here the Midrash tells us, and it came to pass in the days of Amraphel Melech Shinar, Rabbi Yoshua of Sachnin spoke in the name of Rabbi Levi, saying, the wicked have drawn their sword and bent their bow to cast down the poor and the needy and to slay. Right? He just quotes that pasuk. The words, the wicked have drawn out the sword, refer to Amraphel and his cohorts. The words, to cast down the poor and the needy, refer to Lot. And the words, to slay such as are of upright ways, refers to Avraham. So in other words, what this is actually saying to us here is that Lot is essentially, sounds to be that he is an innocent bystander at best. And the other situation is that they were actually targeting him, which we have in the Sferno source 4, which I pointed out to you already, by Chuet Lot ben Achi Avram, hit amsu lishbot et Lot. They specifically made an effort to capture Lot. The Netziv gives a fascinating idea. Go back to our verse. Where is Lot when they capture him? Look at the end of Pasuk Yudbet. V'hu yoshev b'sidom. Indicating he was living in Sidom and he was not out on the battlefield. The Netziv says the reason it says that he was in Sidom is to indicate that it wasn't that they met him on the battlefield and they happened to have taken him, that they specifically targeted him. They went into the city to capture Lot for the reasons that we have suggested already. Now, basically they kidnapped him. That's right. We would call it an example of kidnapping, and we're going to come back to that point as well.
Alternatively,
go ahead.
The kings of Sodom and Amorah fled the battle. They advanced to the rear.
Okay.
And so the conquering army went.
If you read it, actually, if you read the verses carefully, when they did retreat, it seems that they went to hide in what we would know today as those sinkholes all over Sidon, all over the Yam HaMelech. You know, they have those, like, warning, be careful. And if you read the verses carefully, it seems to be that that is where they retreated to the caves and the sinkholes, rather than the city. But perhaps,
they
fled.
Right.
So,
but if they were already sacking Sodom and Gomorrah,
perhaps
Lot
they
was
did.
There.
Okay,
you know,
I will certainly accept that. But let's even take this a step further. If we take this a step further, not only are they coming out to look for Avraham, and not only is this whole war, not only does it is a political war, but now we understand that this is a ideological war. This is a war of ideas, that they're coming to get Avraham and everything he stands for. Now, what's interesting, the fact that Avraham goes out to war, we learn something new about Avraham. That's correct. Until now, we've seen Avraham as the Hachnasat Orchim, as the Chesed, as that type. And here we see that Avraham, when he needs to, he goes out to fight. And sometimes going out to fight is the right and moral thing to do. Thank you, Ronald Reagan. Okay. No, he is the one who explained to the world that going out to fight against the evil empire is the right thing to do. And that is some... Oh, so we'll talk to that in a moment. So we understand that for the most part, I mean, if you think about it, remember Yaakov yells at his sons when they go out to war. Yitzchak moves rather than go to war with Avimelech, but there is a time and a place where you need to go to war. Now let's talk about a minute as you're in. Who are these soldiers who go to war with him? So it says to us here in Pasuk Yudalid, it tells us, Vayishma Avram ki nishba achiv vayarek et chanichav. Any of you who went to summer camp that spoke Hebrew knows the word chanichim, or for Bnei Akiva. Right, there you go. Chanichim are campers in modern day Hebrew. And the interesting thing is it only appears this one time in Torah as chanichav. And based on your modern day knowledge, we would have to assume that chanichim are his disciples. That's a good term.
Yeah, they also use that word for students.
Students, that's correct. And these are
so
obviously, that's right, from the word chinuch. These are obviously the people who have been educated to Avram's. So if this is an ideological war, who is going out to Avram to defend? The students. It makes a tremendous amount of sense that he is going out to them. Now, how many students does Avraham have? He has 318 students. And him and his 318 students are going out to fight against the imperial army. Now, pardon? That would be unbalanced, correct? And not only would that be imbalanced, but if we take it even a step further, some of you might be familiar with the Rashi that we have here in source number 13 at the bottom of page 7. So first, Rashi tells us, Chanichav are his trained men, and then Rashi tells us that these trained men are really not 318 men, these students are actually Eliezer. That the name Eliezer, if you do the Hebrew value of the letters, and it does work, comes out to be Eliezer. Eliezer is 318. So they didn't even go out 319 men, they actually went out two. Now, let's understand this. Is there really a difference saying that he won with two or he won with 319?
Yes.
No. When you're fighting an imperial army, I don't think it really, the numbers are so outnumbered that it doesn't really make a difference. But it also could well be, let me explain this also. It seems to be that, and think about what you know about war, right? The imperial army captures all of the captives. And among the captives, we have to assume are men, women, and children. You're going to take them back to your land. So how do you take them back to your land? You leave a small regiment, and you and your army continue and go elsewhere. Because the captives cannot possibly keep up the pace of an army. So that's what we sort of have to assume happened, that the whole army went continuing on their way, and a small regiment is escorting the men, women, and children back to Mesopotamia. And so that is whom Avraham is attacking. So already, if you put that in that perspective, it makes it a little easier for us to understand. Then so now let me explain to you. Let me stop here and give an important lesson. And I said I would mention of the Kibshan Ha'esh as well. Many times when we're learning, we look at these Medrashim and we say, What? What is Chazal doing? Where did they get it from? What are they trying to accomplish? So I brought for you in source 25, and I just brought you bits and pieces of it. I'm going to say to you, go look it up afterwards. I'm bringing you a story that appears in Sefer Shoftim. The story that appears in Sefer Shoftim is the story of Gideon. Now, it's chapter 6, 7, and 8. Now, in chapter 6, one of the first things that Gideon does is he breaks down the altar of the Baal. One of the first things he does is he smashes the Avodah Zarah. That's in verse 30. Then he goes out to war, and he gathers a huge army. And then God says, there are too many soldiers, get rid of them. So Gideon says, anybody who's afraid, go home. And a whole bunch leave. And God says, there are still too many soldiers. And so again, he sends people home. And then Gideon, you remember this, makes a test. He takes them all down to the water. Anybody who bows into, who puts their head into the river, he says that shows that you worship idols, and he sends them home. And anybody who scoops up the water and drinks, he says, oh, that's it. And I underlined it for you. How many men is Gideon left with in verse 7? He's left with 300 men. Then, before he goes out to war, he says, I need to see what's happening in the enemy camp. So what does he do? Look at where, like, source, Pasuk 9. And it came to pass the same night, and the Lord says to him, arise, go down to the camp that I have given into your hands. And if you fear to go down, go there with Pua, your servant, and go down to the camp. Gideon goes down with one person. He goes down to the camp. He hears them talking. And one guy says, I had this dream. And they understand that God is going to give the camp over into his hands. And then, see, 15, and Gideon heard him telling the dream. And then if you look at verse 16, and he divided the 300 men into three companies, and he puts them into the hands of them horns, and he attacks, and Gideon wins. When you read the story of Gideon, you understand that our story here of Avraham is a very similar story. So why do Chazal say that Avraham smashed the idols? Avraham smashing the idols parallels Gideon smashing the idols. Why do they say that he goes down with one man? Parallels the one man that Gideon goes down with. And just to prove that my point, you see, he divides them into 300 men. If you continue here, when Avraham comes to attack them, look what it says in verse 15 in our story. Vayichalek aleihem laila. Also, Avraham divides, it says it in the verse, his camp, and he attacks the camp in sections the same way Gideon's men do. So you understand, Chazal had such a broad knowledge of Tanakh that when they look at one story, they're able to pull it back to the other story, and they bring the parallels to those stories. So it's not just some random idea. It's because if it what happened there, we can assume it happened here as well. Which I think brings us to a way of looking at this chapter. What we have to look at this chapter is that, I said, not only is it a chapter that tells us that whatever happens in the world affects the Jews, but we also understand the whole concept of all our stories of Bereishit is what we call Ma'aseh Avot Siman Libanim. That which happened to the forefathers happens again to their children. That which happened to Avraham happens to Gideon. That which happens to, now take a look, source number 8. Source number 8 is the Ramban. Ramban, and I didn't find the Ramban in English, but I did find the Bereishit Rabbah, which is very similar. Ramban tells you, you should just know, Hamahazeh hazeh ira la'avam lahorot. This whole event happened in order to teach us, ki arba malchiot ta'amoda limshol be'olam. Many of you are familiar with this concept that there is going to be four major kingdoms that will control world history. And who are those four kingdoms? Greek, Babylonia, Greece, Rome, Persia. Persia, it's Babylonia, Greek, Persia, Babylonia, Persia, Greek, Rome. Okay, those are the four. And the Ramban goes ahead and he tells you how each of those refers to one of those cities. And just the way, one second, let me just finish the point and not take a question. Just the way sometimes you look and you say, how is it possible that the Jews, who are one half of 1% of the world, how will they be able ever to break free? How will they be able to win their independence? So just the way Avraham is able to win against an imperial army with one, and that's the advantage of one over 318, just the way Avram was able to do it, So too, at a certain point in history, the Jews too, even if they're a tiny number, will also be able to win, because obviously the only way they can win is with God on their side.
Why is it Egypt?
The reason Egypt isn't considered one of those four things is because they sort of enslaved us before we were a nation. And that is the answer to that question. And as a matter of fact, but if you think about it for a minute, our story here, and this might explain to you the Og business as well, is actually quite similar to the chapter that we had beforehand. The chapter beforehand, Abraham goes down to Egypt. They take his wife. There are plagues and he is freed. Here too, our story begins with a disaster. Og comes because he wants Avram to be killed, because he wants to take his wife. Again, there is a plague, Vayukam, that is the word that's used there. And just like Avraham leaves Egypt with spoils, here too we have spoils. And this parallels, the Jews came down to Egypt. They said, let's throw all the baby boys in the river, let's leave the women alive. There too, God sends plagues, and they leave with possessions. So when you start looking at these stories in this way, and you understand that they really are mirrors for a much larger question here. Now, let's continue. Yes. We're going to talk about that, I hope. I hope I'm going to get to that. I want to go back to that verse I showed you earlier, that it says, Vayichalek aleihem laila, in verse 15. It says, and he divided on them the night. Now that is grammatically an incorrect way of saying the sentence. So therefore, Rashi comes along, and he tells us that this, it wasn't that he divided the night, but actually the night itself was divided. How was the night itself divided? Let me show it to you inside here. It is... You found it? Source 14, thank you. Source 14, Rosh, no, that's Vayitain Avraham Mikol, that is not it. Oh, here it is, Source 23. This is what I was looking for. First of all, Source 23 is what I was looking for earlier, where he says to the Chanichim, let's go out and fight, and they say to him, look at the underline. Avram says, "Ana ve'epol al kiddush shemo shel makom." Therefore, he says that he's going to go out and fight, even if it is, even if he loses, because sometimes you can't sit quietly. Sometimes you have to go out and fight. The v'chayek aleihem laila that I am looking for, can't I find it? Refers to Rashi. There tells us that actually the night was divided in half. Avraham went out and fought against God's enemies on the first half of the night. And so God says to him, I am going to fight your children in the second half of the night. And you should know this from your Pesach Seder. There's a Pesach Seder, there's a poem that says, Vayihi b'chatzi halayla, and it was in the middle of the night. And it lists a whole bunch of incidences that happened in the middle of the night. And one of those incidents in the middle of the night is this story of Avraham going out to fight with the four kings. So that's another example of Maaseh Avot Siman LeBanim. Not only is it only a plain foreshadowing, but Maaseh Avot Siman LeBanim is also an issue where something the forefathers do come along and actually affect the future and give the children a reward. And I'm going to show you one other quick example of that. One of the things that Abraham says to Melech Sodom, he says, I'm not going to take anything from the top of my head to the heel of my shoe. But you notice he uses the term imi chut viad sroch now. So first of all, what's a chut on the top of the head? No, it's the Arab headdress. They have that thing that they wear around their head. So that's the chut around the head. But why does he use that terminology, chut v'ad srokh nal? And there are many different reasons, but I just want to show you this idea of the foreshadowing. The idea of the foreshadowing shows up here in our source sheet, in the Midrash, in source number, on page number 4, in D. Source 4, D. Amar Rabbi Abba Bar Mamel. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Im amarta im michut chayecha. Shani noten lebanecha mitzvat tzitzit. If you're talking about string, you wouldn't take, you know, from the top of my head, so now I'm going to reward your children with the mitzvah of string. And so how does it have to do with the shoe? He says, therefore, I'm going to give you the mitzvah of yibum, which is, you know, if you don't want to marry this chalitza, you remove the shoe. Okay? Or another opinion is the hamishkan, where you have chutim of different colors. The idea here, though, is the same, that I'm trying to get you to understand, is that the story has a tremendous influence on the future. It has an influence on the future, A, in terms of mirroring, and B, now we see not only in terms of mirroring, but it also has an actual influence on the future ideas as well. But now I want to, yeah. If okay, although where is Amraphel the king of? What does it say in the pasuk? Amraphel is Melech Shinar. Shinar, if you go back to Migdal Bavel. Where is Migdal Bavel? It says there that Migdal de Bavel is in Shinar, and there we find Nimrod in that story as well. So there is what to base it on, I think, as well. But I think that even if you don't say that it's Amraphel per se, that he himself, because I don't think that it needs to be Nimrod hu ba'atzmo, him and himself. There is, I think, there's always this idea of somebody is looking to get rid of the Jews. And let's talk about that, because I'm glad you reminded me that. What is Avraham called in this chapter? The first time Avraham is called here, that when the refugee comes to Avraham in verse 13, Avraham is called Avraham. In Hebrew, he's called Avraham ha-Ivri. Avraham the Ivri. What does it mean that he is the Ivri? Now, you translated Ivri, and perhaps that's the way they do it in English, as the Hebrew from, but that's a much more modern terminology of Ivri. So if you turn to page 4, if you look at C, there we have three explanations about why Avram is called HaIvri. One, Kol ha'ula olam kulo me'aver echad, v'hu me'aver echad. He's called Ivri because he's on the other side of the tracks. That's what we explain. You know, everybody else is on one side and he's on the other. Now, right away, somebody who lives on the other side is
an outsider.
Different. Okay? Then we have, Rabbi Nehemiah says, Shehu mi b'nei b'nav shel Aver. Right? Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Yafes, no, excuse me, and then Shem had a son named Aver, and Avraham is a descendant of Aver, and Rabbanan say, Shehu me Aver Hanar, that he came from the other side of the river. The other side of the river, by the way, is the Euphrates. That he comes from the other side. So you have here, then you would say, like a political a separation, a genetic separation, and a practical explanation as well. But in other words, I think any way you drop this, Avraham is different than everybody else. Now, I'm talking about all of this idea of the purpose of this chapter, and there has to be even more depth to this as well. And I want to talk a little bit about Lot. Many people could look at this story and say, well, why does Lot deserve to be saved? He was living with Abraham. He chose to go live in Sodom, and, you know, you gotta reap the benefits of your choices. How come he deserves to be saved? So it could be that he's doing it because he's Avram's inheritance. That could be as well. But let's look here for a minute at what does the name Lot even mean? Now, I brought you two different verses where you have the word Lot appearing. And you have it here in verse 17 and 18. If you look at 18 and it's 18 and 19. 18 is a verse that appears in Melachim Aleph. And it says about Eliyahu. Vahikishmoa Eliyahu vayalet panav. What does that mean? And it was when Eliyahu heard and he covered his face. So in other words, Lot has something to do with covering. It has something to do with being hidden. And if you turn to 19, this is interesting, when Yosef is being sold to the merchants, it says that the merchants are carrying, verse 19, top of page 9, Vayeshvu lechol lechem, Vayis'u einehem, Vayir'u v'hine orachat yishmelim ba'ami gilad. Right, the brothers sit down to eat and they see this caravan coming. And what is the caravan carrying? Nos'im nechot utzari v'lot. And they are carrying all kinds of spices. And this is an idea that God did a favor to Yosef, that he puts him in a caravan that has nice smelling ideas as opposed to something that is foul smelling. So now, though, when we basically look at Lot, how do you feel about Lot? And you know the stories that come up in the future. Yeah, we're not so happy with Lot, especially if that story with the daughters. Yeah. You know, right. It sort of makes us feel a little bit uncomfortable. But yet, who is a descendant of Lot? Ruth Hamoaviah, and which brings about David HaMelech, which brings about Yimot Mashiach. When Avraham goes out to save Lot, Lot is a hidden personality, but yet there is something there that smells very beautiful. And that when Avraham goes out to save Lot, what essentially is he saving? He's essentially saving the Mashiach. So that again, this becomes a chapter not only of a war between some random countries, but this becomes a chapter really of redemption. It's a chapter of redemption. Lot himself is redeemed. It is also, by the way, when Avraham captures the land, to whom then does the land belong? The land to the victors go the spoils. So in essence, the land of Sodom becomes Avraham's, not because God has given it to him, but because he has captured it. And so what is being saved in this chapter? Land in Eretz Yisrael, Mashiach, Avraham's ideology. All of these things, Bnei Yisrael in the future, perhaps, and as I pointed to you out, that idea of the Ramban is that also, just the way Avraham was able to beat these four kings, that this is symbolic of the ultimate end of the exile that will also come no matter. And by the way, if you noticed, I don't know how many of you picked this up, one of the nations that gets named here in verse 7, you should have been surprised to meet this. Who do you meet there in verse 7? The Amalekim. Okay? What are they doing there?
One
bandits. That's right, and many of you are familiar with the fact that the Rav himself says, who is Amalek today? Any nation that wants to kill us. Okay? That's, unfortunately, there are too many of them, but that's why I think that
when
you have...
So.
That, yeah, that, well, there's much more to that, too, as well. But I think what we recognize here is that we are looking at much more than meets the eye. We have basically almost run out of time, and we have not had a chance to discuss who is Malki Tzedek, which is there. Malki Tzedek, just let me throw out to you quickly, is shame, perhaps, it doesn't matter, but he is the king of Tzedek. What is Tzedek? Who is Malki Tzedek? And that, if you take a quick look here, in the only other time we have Malki Tzedek coming up is in Source 20, but if you look at Source 20, 21, 22, you will notice that Malki Tzedek is the king of Yerushalayim. Avraham comes and gives Ma'aser in Yerushalayim. He gives him bread and wine that obviously represents the karbanot that came with the lechem and the nisuch hayayin. Okay, again, you have more of the foreshadowing there. And the last foreshadow I want to throw out to you is one that you hinted at earlier. Throughout Jewish history, there has always been a halachic question, and that is, if a Jew is taken into captivity, are we A, allowed to risk our lives to save that person, or B, are we not allowed to, are we, do we have to follow it through? And as you can well imagine, the story of Avraham has become a halachic issue, and it's quoted by many of the sources. And what's interesting, though, is if you look at the medieval ages, medieval commentators basically say that you do not have the responsibility to do it, because you shouldn't, your life and risk, why should we have two dead people instead of one? If you look at modern day Israeli poskim from the beginning of Hakamata Medina, they say, as you can well imagine, you don't leave a soldier behind. And that's correct. And that's what's so fascinating about at the time where Jews were individuals, or the time when the Jews have a state. And I think that that perhaps is also one of the strongest ideas here that comes out, is that why does Avraham go to war? A, we don't leave a soldier behind, but if it becomes this issue of the reason they're coming to war is because they're going to fight ideologically, Avraham says, we cannot take this sitting down, and he says, even if it kills me, I am going to go out and defend my family, my name, my God.